This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Yet another candidate tosses a hat in the ring as a Democrat in the 13th District. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan tells why.
Our oldest son, Jack, got Rocky Mountain spotted fever back in 2009 from a tick bite. It sent us on a medical journey that nobody wants to go on.
Running on health care and education, Londrigan is one of half a dozen Democrats mulling over or already in the race. Plus, ISU President Larry Dietz says the state budget is a relief, though it offers the university $7 million less than the state budget of 2 years ago. That's the lowest state support has been for ISU since the early 1990s. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It took more than 2 years, but the state finally has a full budget in place. IPR's Sean Crawford talks with State House reporter Brian Mackey about this long, stymied development.
There was some drama until the very last minute. It took a couple of days this week to get all the House members necessary back to Springfield to cast the vote. One of the Republicans who had voted for it was not going to be there. A number of the other Republicans flipped from yes after initially voting for the tax increase and the budget to no. They said they heard from people this week in their districts who were outraged, and they decided to change their position. But the Democrats were able to make up for those. And in the end, there were still, I believe it was 10 Republicans in the Illinois House on top of one in the Senate who voted for the veto overrides. An even greater number had voted for the budget in the first place earlier in the week. But they did finally get it done.
Well, this takes some pressure off, certainly. It provides money for things like social services, higher education, those areas that had been really hurt during the impasse. But there are still financial concerns going forward for the state of Illinois, aren't there?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, I should point out, it provides less money in some cases. There are cuts in this budget that go across government. And Illinois had really been spending out of control because of the court orders and statutory required spending. So this does bring some discipline back to the spending. But you're right, the problems aren't over yet. Illinois has a $15 billion backlog of bills. There is arrangements in this budget to borrow at a lower interest rate, pay off the highest interest bills we have to some of the medical providers, where we're paying 12% right now. It's kind of like taking out a low interest loan to, you know, pay off your payday loans that you've taken out. So that will be brought down. It'll help bend that cost curve over time. But, you know, it's still going to take a while to dig out of that. Plus, we still have $130 billion in unfunded pension liabilities that credit rating agencies and others are very concerned about. The growing expense of paying that off is crowding out other spending.
Well, the governor never wrote off the idea of a tax increase, income tax increase especially, but he said he wanted things to go along with that. He felt that the a pro-business agenda was needed to be approved for that to happen, for he would sign off on it. Well, they passed the tax increase without him. And now you look at the Democrats, they say they're still willing to work with the governor on some of the things he'd like to see. Any indication that that will happen? Will we see more negotiations, or is that done at least until after the next election?
Well, the Democrats have been saying that. The Republicans who voted in favor of this say that they want to, you know, they wish that the governor's so-called reforms would have gone through, but they couldn't wait any longer. The threat of the junk bond rating, the threat of de-accrediting some of our public universities here, that they feel like they had to take action now. But everybody on both sides of that do say that they want to work on those agenda items. Whether they'll ever be able to get far enough where the governor says, yes, I'm now satisfied with this, I regret those ads attacking you for raising taxes, et cetera, that remains to be seen. And people have been skeptical all along of whether, you know, Democrats could ever go as far as Governor Rauner wants, and, you know, or whether converse way to say that is the way their Governor Round or whatever go as far as the Democrats wanted in raising revenue to balance the budget.
And just a few seconds left here, Brian. Can you sum up the mood of the State House after the budget was finally approved?
This was a big bill. It was a big lift for people. So there was a sense of relief. I think there was a sense of relief that at 2 years of not having a budget, of really irresponsibly running state government, was over. But there was not celebration. People are not happy about this. They're not happy to have to raise taxes. They're not happy at the challenges of the last 2 years. And they know that their work is not done by a long shot.
That's IPR State House reporter Brian Mackey. I'm Sean Crawford.
Illinois State University has lost more than $80 million in state funding over the last 2 years of the budget standoff. That is a 70% reduction, a devastating blow to higher education. ISU President Larry Dietz calls the passage of a budget at long last a welcome change to the stopgap measures, or not having the promise of any funding. But he says the issues are not over.
More meeting of the minds needs to happen more long-term. You know, around the challenges that are facing the state of Illinois, but for Illinois State and for the educational institutions in the state, this at least provides some idea of what our funding will be for this next fiscal year. So that's welcome.
And what is the idea? What is the cut?
Well, we'll be at about $65 million versus $74 million, and so we'll be down some. But they're also going to be covering MAP out of this, and you know, the detail has yet to be worked out on all of that. So there's a you know, an overall funding amount, but they'll have to break that down by institution. But they have addressed that in the bill. So there's going to be some other switches from some expenses that we may need to take over related to some expenses that we haven't had there in the past. But overall, I think the discussion started 2 years ago that part of the solution for the state was a combination of budget cuts and revenue enhancements. And for the last 2 years, the only thing we've ever have experienced have been the budget cuts. And so I know no one wants their taxes increased and so forth, and no one really wants to vote in favor of that. But at the same token, if you're going to have a two-pronged approach, then you have to have both prongs that you're working with. And we've only been working with the cutting prong of this for the last 2 years. So we're pleased that at least we have a dollar amount that we can shoot at and plan around now, and I think we'll be all right.
How much easier does that make life?
Well, it makes life a lot easier in terms of the planning. The old adage that the emotions of love and hate are strong emotions, but the worst emotion is apathy, and just and frankly we've kind of felt that nobody cares much about education because there's been no scheme and no plan to fund it that has been acceptable in both sides of the aisle. And so this to me is sends a good message that people can come together on both sides of the aisle and pass something to try to get the state back on track and therefore higher education back on track. But there's been a lot of damage done that will take years to repair, if it's repairable at all. But the first step's got to be to put something in place that we can all work around, and having a dollar amount that we can plan around helps us tremendously.
You mentioned other expenses the university might have to assume. What are those?
Well, they're talking about some pension shifts, for some of the various programs, and we haven't seen the detail of all that yet for me to be very articulate about that. But we may have some of those shifts. But the overall today, I know that the bill didn't have some of the structural realignments that the governor had hoped for, and that a lot of the Republican Party had not hoped for. But we needed some stability, and I think this measure provides a message of some stability, and then folks can get about the business of you know, try to work out the other issues. So, you know, we're just glad to have a number and that we can plan around and move forward. Though, frankly, the number is lower than we've had in many, many years, and you know, it's going to be tough to plan around that. But at least we know what we're shooting at now.
Does it really provide stability, though? I mean, some of the Republicans who voted against it, such as State Senator Jason Berrickman, who represents this area, say the budget is still $1 to $2 billion out of balance.
Well, that's true. That's true. All I'm saying in terms of the stability is that we have a dollar amount now that, and it's not our job as university presidents to balance the state's budget. It is our job to provide, you know, teaching, research, and service to our constituency groups. And you know, I respect Jason and other legislators who have voted their conscience today. That's what they're elected to do, and we can all have agreements and disagreements about that. But, you know, my job as a university president and all the other presidents and chancellors in the state is to provide the best product that we can provide, and that's very difficult to do without knowing where the money's coming from. And so we at least know what we might have for a current fiscal year, and that's helpful.
What is the percentage reduction from the last time ISU had a budget?
Well, in fiscal year for Illinois State, in fiscal year 15, we had about $74 million from the state. And we had about 4,000 students receiving about $15 million in MAP money. And in fiscal year, so that was the last budget year. The numbers now are about $65 million. And coverage of MAP, we hope. And so we will have gone from 74 to 65. And, you know, we that doesn't count, you know, the 2 years that we didn't have a budget, and we've had to, you know, try to figure out how to make ends meet during those 2 years, and we've done that. We've been fortunate in that our enrollment has been strong. But I think one of the advantages to having a budget is that hopefully it'll send a message to parents and students who have been leaving the state to go to school in other states because they haven't had confidence in the state to provide funding for higher education. Hopefully it will send a bit of a message as we begin this next recruiting year here in just a couple of months for next year, that there has been some stability. I think there's still a lot of work to be done during this year to try to figure out how to get the funding mechanisms together to fund what they just passed. And then I think if there's also some structural issues that need to happen in the state, that's what the elected officials are elected to do, is to try to work that out. So I have confidence that reasonable people can come together and make decisions. That doesn't mean that they always get their way, but I think, you know, that government generally is supposed to be providing things for individuals, people who can't provide those things for themselves, programs and services for themselves. And so hopefully, you know, both sides of the aisle would get together and perhaps use that as their mantra for planning for the future.
Well, can anybody reasonably declare victory out of this?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that this was, you know, I think this has been power politics. It's been that way for 2 years. And it just gives you a little bit of breathing room, but, you know, the basic issues are still there.
Will this stability and the ability to plan allow ISU to replace some of the 120 positions that have been held open during this standoff?
Too early to say, but I kind of doubt that. We've dug a pretty good hole in for the last 2 years in some areas. You know, we'll look at that, but it's going to be into the fall before we really know the you know, what our fall enrollment's going to be. It'll be the 10th day of that. That's a big figure for us that we have to contend with. So it's going to be you know, a few months down the road before we'll even address that.
Illinois State University President Larry Dietz expressed relief at the passage of a budget. The university indicates the last time ISU's state support was this low was the early 1990s, more than 20 years ago. After yesterday's votes, a coalition of more than 300 organizations across the state called the Responsible Budget Coalition praised the end of the budget nightmare, as they called it. But for local nonprofit agencies like PATH and the YWCA of McLean County, the budget isn't the end of the story. GLT's Ryan Denham asked Christy Germanis about what's next for her organization, the YWCA.
So what does it mean for the YWCA of McLean County that the state now has a budget finally?
Well, we applaud our legislators for finally taking a stand and saying enough is enough, that we have to have some type of budget in place. However, we do feel that this is just a first step, that this isn't obviously the solution. In reality, the budget being passed yesterday really doesn't change our current situation. Over the past 2 years, without a budget, the damage has been done. We've closed a program, and we won't be reopening it, unfortunately. We've scaled back services, we've laid off staff, and hopefully we'll be able to start getting payments again in a timely manner, and we can begin to rebuild.
What was the program that was closed down and won't be reopening?
We closed Medivan, which is our medical transportation. It was a door-through-door service for clients for medical appointments, for non-emergent medical appointments.
In what ways, if you could just describe overall, Christy, in what ways does the YWCA still rely on the state for its programs?
Okay, so out of all of our programs, we have a wide variety of funding sources for all of our programs. So we'll start with Medivan, which was the program that was just closed. Medivan was 85% funded by the state. Home care services, which is also another adult service that we have that provides care to folks in their homes that can't do the daily tasks of living, but they still want to stay in their homes. We want to keep people safe and independent in their homes. That is 84% state funded as well. We also receive state funding for Stepping Stones, which is our rape crisis center. It's funded 48.5% actually by the state, that budget is. And then our early learning program, so this is our 6 weeks to 5-year-old children, it's 55% state funded. We do have some other changes in another programming that we have had to make, but we're still communicating with staff and our clients, and we'll have more information on that next week. But that's going to be a major change.
Can you describe the mood at all over at the YWCA of McLean County yesterday as, you know, as legislators actually finally locked this in and this thing was finally done?
Well, I think that it's kind of bittersweet because we need a budget, and we need to start getting paid. And hopefully this is going to speed up our process. The state currently owes us more than $500,000, and it's actually closer to $750,000 that they owe us. So, and we don't even know if we're going to see that money, because those were services rendered during years where we didn't have a budget in place, and they won't guarantee those funds. So we'll see what comes in, and hopefully we will get that funding.
That was Christy Germanis from the YWCA of McLean County. You're listening to GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm also going to ask Karen Zangerly from PATH, Providing Access to Help, what the state budget passage means to her organization.
We were really overjoyed yesterday when it did, the override was successful. I know that the budget is very flawed, and it's going to take a long time to work out all of the issues, but the fact that there is a budget allows some state agencies to go ahead and start paying people for what they've done. United Way of Illinois had predicted that if there was no budget, that we would lose 38% of social services in the state of Illinois, and that would be a tragic thing. I'm glad that PATH is not in danger, and many agencies now have hope.
Can you kind of juxtapose those two things? Like what the social service network kind of looked like before all this started two and a half years ago and what it looks like today?
We had a lot more services available to the community for the people over age 60, for individuals with disabilities, and for our children, our most vulnerable children. But we had services that could respond to those needs. Over the last 2 years, that's all fallen back. And I know that having spoken to a couple of people from agencies just in the last few hours, that at least some of them feel like, okay, there's hope. You know, we're gonna stick it out. We know that things will not change overnight. It's going to be a long haul. But I think that agencies are in a place where they've lost a great deal, but having a budget means there might be possibilities for the future.
That was Karen Zangerle, Executive Director at PATH, providing access to help. Before that was Christy Germanis from the YWCA of McLean County. I'm Ryan Denham.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There is another entry into the Democratic race for Congress in the 13th District. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan of Springfield says she wants to make people's lives better. She says right now they're scared of losing jobs, scared of losing insurance, generally scared. Londrigan has never run for office before, and she shares via Skype what prompted her to take the step now.
Well, the protections that we have in place right now have meant everything to my family, the health care that we have available to us. When our oldest son, Jack, he got Rocky Mountain spotted fever back in 2009 from a tick bite. And it sent us on a medical journey that nobody wants to go on. He landed in the pediatric intensive care unit here at St. John's Children's Hospital. And he received amazing care from the medical team there. I mean, they kept him alive every minute of every day for a long time. And so I'm very thankful for the care that he received. And when we got out of the hospital, you know, we weren't thinking about the bills while we were there. We were focused on just making sure that Jack stayed alive. And the medical bills were astronomical. 21 days in a pediatric intensive care unit, surgeries. It was a lot. And then he had years of physical rehabilitation afterwards. And so the insurance that my husband and I had really saved our family. And so do the not having the caps. Our life would look entirely different if we didn't have insurance or if the caps were in place. And I'm very grateful for that. And I don't want any other family to have to go through a medical emergency, which is horrifying in and of itself, and then to come out of it and face losing a home, not being able to help their kids go to school. And it's a frightening position to be in, and I'd like to help protect people from that.
Other Democrats already in the race have talked about preferring a single-payer system or at the very least moving toward it with reforms to the Affordable Care Act. Where do you stand on that spectrum?
Well, I think that there will be time down the road to look at specific plans for alternatives. Right now, I want us to fix what we have. And then when we're moving forward, we can look at plans. I would want to know how we can best protect people and the economic impact that it's going to have on our district. Before I would vote for anything, I would have to see the legislation, know the economic impact, and how it's going to affect us all.
Without advocating for a particular proposal, what about the Affordable Care Act do you think needs fixing?
Well, I know that even at our own at family dinners on Sundays, sometimes it works. I mean, it works for some of us. It doesn't work for others. I mean, I think there's some, you know, some formulas that need to be tweaked. And I'd love to be able to dive in to, you know, to being part of fixing the problems.
Does that include keeping the individual mandate, doing away with it? What are the problems that make the Affordable Care Act a little shaky?
Well, I don't know that that question can be answered simply. I think it's a complex issue, and I think we have to go in and look at it right now. Because you start talking about, you know, the formula for subsidies and how that affects the, you know, different areas. So I don't know that I can give a simple answer to how to fix it right now. I think it's complex.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan of Springfield, a Democratic candidate for Congress in the 13th District against incumbent Republican Rodney Davis, or at least that's the hope if she gets past the primary. Let's talk about Congressman Davis a little bit. He has said that the Affordable Care Act is a system designed to fail, that the exchanges are not working, and as a result, they are producing premiums that are far too expensive for ordinary Americans to afford. Your thoughts on that particular quote?
Well, you know, I feel a little bit about that answer, like I feel about when people are critical of public education. You can't keep undercutting a program and then expect the best outcomes. And I think that's what's happening with the ACA. And instead of getting in and funding it adequately and making it work and using the bones that are there, undercutting it every step of the way is just making it, it's crippling it.
This race is not currently, according to the Cook Political Report, rated as competitive. Why do you think they're wrong?
Well, you know, I've been in this district for, I mean, most of my life, but for college and doing Teach for America for a couple of years. And I've seen a big difference in the way people are feeling. For a long time, you know, I have been on the sidelines of campaigns, and I've talked to a lot of people, and there was, you know, there's always room for people to be disgruntled, and occasionally they were angry. But the difference I'm seeing now is that people are genuinely frightened of what they feel, you know, they stand to lose. And that makes people very active and protective. And I think that, you know, they want somebody in office who's approachable, who will talk with them, who will listen to them, and then take those concerns back to Washington. And I think there's a general feeling that that's not what's happening right now.
Among the potential and announced candidates on the Democratic side in the race are an emergency room physician who's run many times before, a state senator from Champaign-Urbana who was a single mom and has moved into politics that way, an English and theater instructor at a high school in Normal, a U of I person, and the Jersey County State's Attorney. Distinguish yourself from them and tell us why you will make a better candidate against Rodney Davis than they will.
Well, first of all, I love that there's this much interest in the 13th Congressional District. I think it's fantastic. And I think I'm the best candidate for this race because this place and the people here are in my bones. And I think that we want the same things, and people aren't asking for, you know, the moon. They want good jobs. They want health care, and they want health insurance that is affordable and works for them. They want to be able to, you know, help their kids further their education without being completely crippled with debt. And they'd like to think that maybe at some point those kids that they send off to community college or a four-year university or into an apprenticeship program, that they might want to come back to the area, there'd be jobs here for them, and raise their families around here, maybe have family dinners on Sundays. And those are the things that, you know, that I hear from people. And those are the same things that I want. I've got two boys in college right now, and I would love to think that down the road there'd be the economy here is strong enough and the jobs are available that they might want to come back here, raise their families, so I can, help out with the grandkids.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, a Democratic candidate for Congress in the 13th District. It's expensive to run for Congress. Some candidates, in fact, dump out of even the attempt because they can't afford to leave their work for the 18 months that it takes to run and try to raise $100,000 a month every month until the election. Can you do that?
Absolutely. And I have never been one to shy away from a challenge. My experience in fundraising helps me with the first hurdle I think a lot of candidates face, which is being scared of fundraising. And I'm not. I guess the difference in being a candidate is making that switch to asking people to make an investment in you. And that's what I'm doing. I'm asking people to make an investment in me to help, to help put their voice back in Congress.
Tell us more about your background and why it suits you.
Well, I have had, for the last 7.5 years, I have had the pleasure of working at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. And also in that time, I worked for Senator Dick Durbin, doing some of his downstate fundraising. And so I think I have amazing political mentors in Senator Durbin and in President Abraham Lincoln. And I think that my experience in fundraising with the Presidential Library Foundation has set me up for making the ask of people and helping them get to a place where they feel that their investment is worth it.
The 13th District has, 7 universities in it, a lot of agriculture. Tell us how you would address those two constituencies.
Well, with education right now, what students are facing, especially with this new budget, it increases the interest burden of the students, and it freezes Pell Grants, so students are going to have to borrow more. And it doesn't offer the public loan forgiveness. I'm a huge advocate of public service. And I think that if we can, if we can help kids finance their college by going into public service afterwards, it's a fantastic idea. And it's a win-win for everybody, in my opinion.
An infrastructure bill has been something that has been stalled in Congress for a long time, because it needs revenue to support it. It needs either a gas tax increase or a way to tax vehicles that do not run on gasoline. Where do you think the way forward is in that large and thorny issue?
Well, that was something that that President Trump really focused on during the campaign, and I was hopeful that his budget would reflect that. Instead, it reflects, big cuts to infrastructure and to the Tiger Grant specifically. And, I think we lost we'll lose about $500 million in Tiger Grants. And that's exactly the money that we need for infrastructure projects.
There's also a proposal to eliminate long-distance routes for Amtrak in the state of Illinois and across the nation, leaving basically 4 or 5 disconnected corridors of passenger rail service. What would that do to the state of Illinois if it comes to pass, and how would you suggest moving forward or not on that?
Well, I'm a big proponent of Amtrak. I would have to look at that more closely before I think I could give you an effective answer, because I am not sure which lines would be closed and how that would affect the areas around them.
Other than health care, what do you think is the most important issue to address in this campaign?
Well, I think in in this district in particular, there is a trifecta of healthcare, education, jobs. In this district, they're so intimately tied together. Education-related services and healthcare-related services make up about 30% of the jobs in the district. So you can't really talk about one without talking about the others. Let's protect our healthcare, let's protect our education services, and protect our jobs while we're doing it.
Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan also says the Second Amendment needs to be protected, though guns should be kept out of the hands of those who should not have them. She is distantly related to the late Republican Senator Everett McKinley Dirksen of Illinois and spoke with GLT via Skype. There are more than half a dozen Democrats announced or considering the race against Rodney Davis of Taylorville.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With energy, humor, and hip-hop verse, Shakespeare's timeless masterpiece Romeo and Juliet moves to a new rhythm from the Q Brothers Collective. In 2015, the Q Brothers created the well-received adaptation of Two Gentlemen of Verona at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. Backed by popular demand, they've again swapped iambic pentameter for hip-hop in their latest adaptation, I Heart Juliet. Every aspect of the show embraces a contemporary sensibility, including the original costumes created just for the show. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more with a designer who's dressing the star-crossed lovers and their feuding families.
In the basement costume shop of the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, needle and thread meet material in a moment of creation that helps bring a fresh look to characters who have lived a long theatrical life. The costumes are for I Heart Juliet. It's Romeo and Juliet as no one has ever heard before or seen before. Christina Leinecke is the costume designer for I Heart Juliet. An Illinois State University graduate, Leinecke says she began work on the costumes late last year. And after a series of production meetings with the Q Collective and director Kevin Rich, Leinecke began shaping the sartorial details of the characters.
I start with research collages of the ideas and the conversations with our director based on the inspiration that the script has given us, and then we turn that into thumbnail sketches, which become the finished costume sketches.
So there's a real process going over months and months and months.
About 6 months before we show up in Bloomington Normal to start building the costumes.
Kevin Rich is directing,
yes.
And the Q Brothers Collective wrote I Heart Juliet. This isn't your first time working with the Q Brothers.
No, I worked with them. I first met them, actually, and worked with them here on Q Gents. And then they asked me to design some corporate gigs for them, as well as redesign Othello the Remix, which was in New York this December.
That must have been very exciting for you.
It was. It was my first New York design. So that was an exciting moment for me to have work presented in one of the biggest theater capitals in our country.
Well, they're very original. They're very unique. What's it like working with them?
Oh, they are a lot of fun. We have a great rapport together. I haven't gotten to speak as directly with them on this production since Kevin is serving as director. And most of my conversation goes through him, and he has conversations with the playwrights at that point. But we have a great time brainstorming together and riffing off of one another and coming up with the best visual joke, because a lot of time we have these ideas that we get from the scripts, and we've created sort of the blueprint of how we will move forward with the design. But when we get on our feet or in rehearsal, new ideas come up all the time. And so I try to preserve a certain amount of my budget so that we can find the most functional joke or the best way to tell the story or communicate visually with the audience very quickly.
So you say joke. Mm-hmm. We are talking about Romeo and Juliet, which has kind of a downer ending.
It does.
But you guys are finding a way to work humor into this.
Yes. You know, the Q Brothers, whether they are adapting a comedy or a tragedy, there's a great deal of comedy in all that they do. One of the things I think they excel at when they're adapting a tragedy is that they find these moments to I almost say kick you in the gut, or it's like all of the air goes out of the room when you hit those tragedy moments when there is a death of a character you have grown to love over the course of this play.
And the humor helps build that affection for the character, and it's just like in real life when you're just laughing with a friend and then the next minute something terrible can happen.
Absolutely. I think that's one of my favorite things about Shakespeare in general, too, is that life is neither all tragedy or all comedy. It's often both at the same time. Those moments of tragedy make us appreciate those moments of comedy, and those moments of comedy make us appreciate the depth of human feeling and emotion. So it's a real privilege to get to work with them on this, because I tend to favor humor in life as well, but to appreciate and use it as a foil for those real moments of depth of feeling and tragedy in the human experience.
Well, how do you do a visual joke through costume?
There are several examples. Some are written into the script, like in I Heart Juliet, the Coen brothers wrote a sequence of dancing potion bottles and a dancing rug, or there is a race between a pigeon and a penguin. So those visual jokes are things I come up with. There are others where we have to kind of go through and figure out some of the costume pieces that we can give the characters to enhance what they're already doing in the script. So, for example, Tybalt is a character who retained a lot of the original Shakespeare text or meaning to his final version of the character. And so Kevin had the idea that he wanted him to be more Elizabethan in appearance, that he might be sort of that kid in the theater club in high school who lives very theatrically. He has this big dramatic cape that he wears while as everyone else is walking around in modern dress clothing, so he can gesture dramatically and live as dramatically as his character is speaking in the play.
As you're in modern dress, is this a situation where you can just go, I could do a Target run and get most of my costumes, or do you make everything from scratch?
We shop a lot of the show. I have a tendency with the different torsos that we make to shop brand new things so that I can cut them up and piece them together and make them a new thing that can go on and off very quickly as a whole character costume.
So there's a lot of deconstruction going on.
There is. We take apart a lot of things. I feel very guilty as a lover of clothes that I buy brand new things to take them apart, cut them up, and only use pieces of to make a character costume.
Let's talk about Romeo and Juliet and the costumes that you've created for them. Can you show me some of your renderings?
I would love to. All right. That's that pigeon and penguin we talked about there.
So they're people in costumes, not an actual pigeon or penguin.
Of course, they're probably going to be towards the back. There's some potion bottles. This is Juliet's sketch. She has evolved a bit from her initial costume design.
She has a little waspishness going on about her.
She does. So one of the things we wanted to explore in the differences between the two families is that the Capulets are more of a privileged country club group of people, and the Montagues are more of blue-collar workers.
So that really heightens the differences between the families and why they might be feuding.
Absolutely. And the Coen brothers provided a profession for the Montague family. They work in a fish market, the Montague family fish market. And we didn't have a profession at first for the Capulets. And so one thing I asked them to think about and create for me was a profession or a family business, so I had some idea what might motivate the Capulet clothing choices. One thing we had talked about was then the Capulet golf and yacht. so they have a golf and yacht business. You're going to see a lot of golf in Lord Capulet and in Perry. They even have golf clubs. We had this idea for a Juliet golf costume earlier, but as the script kept evolving, we didn't really need that costume anymore, so we instead, she stays in her pink dress, but we have layered a precious little pink sort of dressing robe with it for the moments that are more private or in the bedroom.
Very princessy.
Very princessy. She's mommy and daddy's little princess, but she does not wish to be a princess, so we have some more edgy accessories for her, like she has a hot pink bralette that she wears underneath there, and then she has a white and pink studded belt with skulls on it that she wears with her pink chiffon and lace dress.
So there's a lot of really fun detail in this. Do you have a lot of fun doing that?
I do. You know, one thing I do on Q Brothers show that I don't do on other shows necessarily is I spend a lot of time with an embroiderer. So I have a lot of costume pieces custom embroidered for the show. For example, we're making uniform patches for any of the Montague men who have a uniform shirt on. We have their all four of their ball caps are getting a fish logo embroidered on it that was designed for the show. We have some of the Capulet things are getting golf crests and things like that put on. It's a way of sort of finishing and making them look more real and lived in rather than something we purchase just for a stage performance.
Do you have a favorite costume that you've designed?
For this show?
Yes.
I'd say so far the potion bottles have turned out to be quite entertaining. I'm very, very fond of them. When I make costumes myself, I tend to be more of a dressmaker, and I'm blessed to have such a wonderful costume crafts department who takes all of the crazy things that I design and turns them into, you know, real costume pieces. So the potion bottles are foam tabards that they put over their neck that we have decorated in bright metallic colors with holographic silver pieces to look like potion bottles, and then they get bubbles. They have helmets that are a cross between like 1960s space helmets and what pop culture thought those looked like at the time, and they'll get silver glitter antennae coming out of the top of them. So it's going to be quite entertaining. The actors all really enjoyed putting those on for the first time.
It would be nice if these costumes could live on afterwards in sort of a cosplay kind of an existence.
They might. They might. They could be used again here. On occasion, there's a rental agreement between organizations. If the show gets produced somewhere else, Illinois State University may choose to rent the costumes. They may choose not to. I would love it if they had a different life here in a production at Illinois State University, because I'm just dying to see how they would use them.
Well, speaking of ISU, you did your undergraduate work here, right?
I did. I was here from 2004 to 2008, and I have a Bachelor's of Science in in theatrical design and production, which has an emphasis in costume design.
So what did you learn here that you've been able to take with you that really has made a change in you and your work?
I would say that I was quite spoiled when I was here, and I didn't realize how spoiled I was to be a part of such a large program. Not every school has a program this large. They do not produce as much work. They do not have as many opportunities for students. And like many schools, though, I took advantage of all of the opportunities that were available. I really, really think that the hard work of theater was what was passed on to me here, that this is fun and it is joyful. But it is a lot of work. It is a lot of hours. If you want to make it your life's work, you need to be willing to put in the time. And some people love it and are unwilling to give that level of time commitment to it. But I think Illinois State University did a great job of preparing me for how hard I was going to have to work to make my living this way.
You know, of course, Romeo and Juliet has been with us for centuries, and there have been so many different versions of it out there. How do you think people are going to react to I Heart Juliet and its, you know, the Q Collective's take on this famous tragic romance?
I love their approach to this version of Romeo and Juliet, because they emphasize the what if, the near misses. Why do we tell this story over and over again? And I think that's an important conversation to have. I like to think we have this conversation over and over again, and why it's still important is because when we allow hate and judgment to cloud the better part of ourselves, we inevitably set in motion events that could result and do result in tragedies like this one, where you wind up losing the thing you love most in the world. And in this case, it's the life of your children. It's so frustrating as an audience member, right? Because we sit there and go, oh, he dies as she wakes up, and what if there were just a few seconds longer, or she woke up a few seconds faster, or, but it never works that way. And audiences for centuries have been coming to see this play to relearn that lesson and have that lesson told to them again. I think what's great about I Heart Juliet, though, is with all of the humor, we get to celebrate the things about the play that we love, as well as make fun of the things about the play that we think are frustrating in the humor in the show. I would love it if the show has life beyond our festival and is produced throughout the country, because I think it's a great way to tell this story, especially to younger audiences who maybe are tired of the standard classroom version.
That's Christina Leinecke, costume designer for I Heart Juliet at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. And now, the bad news. I Heart Juliet is already sold out. However, there is a waiting list for tickets. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see photos of the costume designs, including Christina Leinecke's modeling one of the dancing potion bottle costumes she created, at our website, WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can hear individual stories and entire episodes of the show at our website. Thanks to Ryan Denham and Laura Kennedy for providing the show today. You can contact us at news@wglt.org. This is GLT, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.